Here's a Cattle Cast Rewind.
From their humble beginnings in Cuba, Emilio and Gloria Estefan came to America and broke through all barriers to become a crossover sensation at the very top of the pop music world. On Your Feet takes you behind the music and inside the real story. Joining me now on CattleCast are Christine Prates and Mauricio Martinez, who play the record-making couple in the hit musical. Welcome to CattleCast.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
There's nothing I can do. I'm helpless in your arms. Oh, baby, what you do? I'm in love and this is it. There's no turning back this time. No, no, no. Here we are, all alone. Trembling hearts, beating strong. Reaching out, breathless kiss. I never thought could feel like this.
This is Bailey Sisoy Isgrow, author of Rosie, A Detroit Her Story, and you're listening to CattleCast.
Welcome to another episode of CattleCast, presented by Capital Area District Libraries. It's the podcast that provides a nice mix of information and entertainment.
Thanks for joining us for the CattleCast podcast. I'm Mark Bazita, library assistant for the Downtown Lansing branch of Capital Area District Libraries. It's Hispanic Heritage Month, so let's celebrate the many contributions of Hispanic and Latino Americans to our nation and society. Congratulations to Stu Rankin, who knew that Mason was the key word from our last episode, so he will receive a Kindle Fire. This episode is jam-packed with interviews, including Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, who will be here to discuss her new book about the Flint water crisis. We will also be speaking to an ex-NYPD detective who headed up the country's first rap intelligence unit, so you don't want to miss that. And digital literacy librarian Courtney Tang will provide us with this month's cattle keyword. Dr. Mona is next. You're listening to CattleCast.
At your Capital Area District Libraries, everything is right here. And now you can access thousands of films on demand with Canopy. Choose from hundreds of new films each month, available on a variety of devices and platforms. Your Cattle Card provides free access to thousands of films, from award-winning documentaries to hard-to-find titles and classics. It's the world's finest cinema, now free to you. From your Capital Area District Libraries, celebrating 20 years of providing great service. Log on to cadl.org today.
My first guest is Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, the crusading pediatrician whose research exposed the Flint water crisis. She has been awarded the Freedom of Expression Courage Award, named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People in the World, and her new memoir, What the Eyes Don't See, is receiving rave reviews. Dr. Mona, welcome to CattleCast.
It is great to be here with you.
We are so honored to have you here.
Likewise.
How did you first recognize that there was a problem in the water?
Yeah, so I was actually tipped off by a friend, a high school girlfriend. Her name is Elin Batanzo, who was over my house for dinner, and she told me that there was a concern about the water. My high school friend happens to be a drinking water expert, so amazing to have such a friend. And she had heard from a former colleague of hers who worked at the EPA that the water wasn't being treated properly in Flint, and because of that, there would be lead in the water. So this kind of gets at the title of my book, What the Eyes Don't See. So it's nothing I saw in my patients. It's nothing I saw in my clinic. It's nothing I even saw in the water, because lead in water is invisible and odorless and tasteless. So it was all kind of act of serendipity that I was tipped off and found out that there was lead in the water. And that really kind of started my work to find out if it was impacting our children.
And you almost wonder what would happen if you had not been exposed to that.
I think about that all the time, and I think one of the lessons of the story in this book is hang out with girlfriends, have glasses of wine together, sure. Reconnect with folks who are different from you, who are of different professions from you, because you never know what you will learn.
In other interviews, you have stated that your upbringing led to your role in sounding the alarm about the water crisis. Can you share some of the things about your childhood?
Absolutely. So, you know, this book is not just a Flint water crisis book. That would have been kind of easy for me to write. So I took a risk, and I really wanted to weave in who I am and where I came from. Because to know what I did and what I do, you really have to know how I came to be that person. So I am an immigrant. We came to this country when I was four. We were fleeing the regime of Saddam Hussein, fleeing the dictatorship, the oppression, the tyranny, the fascism. And my parents came here for freedom, for democracy, for opportunity, mm-hmm. very much for that American dream. So the milieu of my childhood was every day grateful to be in this country, but also very much cognizant of what can happen to vulnerable populations. I acutely knew what injustice was and what people in power could do to vulnerable populations. And it is with that lens that I pledged, you know, my career to service and went into medicine and found myself in Flint.
Did you always have aspirations to become a pediatrician?
I don't know. I started out as an environmental activist. That's how I started out in high school and college. I studied environmentalism, did a lot of organizing, did a lot of social justice work and civic engagement work, but really was drawn to medicine as the most ultimate really form of service. I started to connect the dots between what can happen in the environment and what can happen in your health. So created my own major in environmental health and then came here to Michigan State University for medical school. I really wanted to be at a place that focused on communities, focused on service, focused on primary care. And then my last 2 years here as a medical student at Michigan State was in Flint. MSU was the very first community-based medical school. So I got to do my clinical training in Flint, which is where I fell in love with the city. And I fell in love with the discipline of pediatrics.
Everyone agrees that it's unacceptable that any child, you know, would be exposed to lead through the drinking water. But there are different opinions among your colleagues regarding the possible long-term effects.
Sure. I don't think there's any dispute of that science. Everybody knows what the long-term consequences of lead. There's no denying the science. And national organizations, the World Health Organizations, the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, the American Academy of Pediatrics, have all come to consensus that there is no safe level of lead. And we now know through incredible science that the lowest levels can also greatly impact children's cognition and behavior and alter a child's life course trajectory. So the consensus of all of these medical and public health organizations is that we have to do something called primary prevention, which means never exposing a child to lead because it is an irreversible neurotoxin.
How difficult is that?
It's very difficult. One of the reasons the title of my book is What the Eyes Don't See, not only do we not see lead in water, we also don't see the consequences of lead. It's known in the pediatric world as a silent pediatric epidemic. I love to trick my students, my trainees. I'm like, how does a kid with lead poisoning present? And they'll be like, oh, he's got headaches and stomach aches and he's doing bad in school. Well, you don't see any of that. They're asymptomatic, which is why we have to ask questions and why we have to screen. So for a physician, we're often very myopic. We often only see what's in front of us. We're trained to take care of acute emergencies and intoxications. Mm-hmm. And if a kid isn't seizing and, you know, showing in a coma and, you know, with signs of an acute intoxication, we often don't recognize the long-term impact that something like lead can have on a child. So there's still a lot of education that needs to be done. But it is difficult to make sure that our children are never exposed to lead because it's a heavy metal. It persists in the environment. We use it in our paint for a long time. Mm-hmm. We use it in gasoline for a long time. It's contaminated our soil. And it was in our plumbing. Not until actually 2014 did we restrict lead from our brass fixtures. So it is going to take a large investment in infrastructure to eliminate lead from children's environments.
Now, are you currently treating children who you've treated for long-term effects of lead poisoning?
Yeah. So in Flint, we are considering that all children were exposed to the lead water. So for 18 months, people were drinking this water and they had no idea that it had lead in it. So we have framed this crisis, this population-wide exposure, as a population-wide contamination. And this was, you know, supported by the state and supported by the CDC. But we've also framed this crisis as one added toxic stress to to a population already rattled with toxic stresses. So the concept of toxic stress is really emerging in pediatrics and public health. It is the recognition of the multiple adversities that children face to really succeed. And all of these adversities impact a child's development. So even before the crisis, our kids in Flint were living in crisis. We have an almost 60% poverty rate for our kids, one of the highest violent crime rates in the country, no full-service grocery stores, you name it, every disparity you can think of, we already have in Flint. And this water crisis, which is not just about lead, it is a crisis. We had an outbreak of Legionnaires' disease where people died. We had skin issues. It's also a crisis of trust and trauma. So we have framed this entire trauma of the water crisis as an added toxic stress on top of a population already rattled with all these toxic stresses. And when you frame it that way, we can lean on the incredible science of brain development and child development and resilience to mitigate the impact of this trauma. And that's exactly what we are doing in Flint right now.
Did race and or economics play a role in the Flint crisis?
Absolutely. And that's been well documented in several investigations. The Michigan Civil Rights Commission, the governor's task force, which looked into the water crisis, clearly point to this water crisis as a form of environmental injustice. Environmental injustice is the concept that people who are poor, people who are predominantly minority, disproportionately suffer from the burden of environmental contamination. I think it was Jesse Jackson who called this a racial crisis. Michael Moore said this never would have happened in a whiter or richer city, and that is absolutely true.
We talked before we started here about your book and how the book doesn't have an ending. This is not over yet. As we are recording this today, what is the quality of Flint's tap water right now?
Yeah, so I think the hardest part about writing this book was stopping. I wanted to go on and on, not only with the constant editing and OCD style I have make it perfect, but it was also difficult to figure out where to end this story because Flint is not history. Flint continues. And I hope that my book, too, can really continue to share the hope that we have created in Flint. So this story is very much about the crisis in this water crisis. It's also a story about activism and resistance, and it is absolutely a story about how we can all open our eyes and bring hope in our communities. So where we are in Flint right now in terms of the water, we're actually still under a public health emergency because our pipes are being replaced. That will be done by 2020. Once our pipes are replaced, that will get rid of the damaged lead pipes. Mm-hmm. When you replace that pipe, the pipes, when you do that infrastructure work, you disrupt the lead scale that's underneath, and that's why people still need to take precautions. We still have a ways to go in terms of the water, but it's actually for a good reason. We're replacing our pipes, and we're learning from you guys. There's only two other cities in this country that have replaced their lead pipes, Lansing, Michigan, and Madison, Wisconsin. And once Flint does it, we'll be the third city. Those two other cities took them over a decade, and we're doing it in less than half of that. We're on our way, you know, full pipe replacement and right sizing of our infrastructure. But in terms of the children, which is where I get to spend my every day, making sure that they not only recover and thrive, we have built a model public health program that we also hope to export to other cities that are suffering from very similar toxicities.
Talk about the pediatric public health initiative.
Yeah, so currently I direct the Michigan State University and Hurley Children's Hospital Pediatric Public Health Initiative. And this is that model public health program to flip the story for Flint kids. It is all about making sure that our Flint children have the brightest future possible. We are throwing every evidence-based intervention at our children to promote their development. You know, we can't take away this crisis. There's no magic pill. But we are leaning on that incredible science of resilience building to make sure that our kids have those promoting strategies. So, for example, as a community, working hand in hand with our community, with our parents, and even with the kids of Flint, we have put into place massive investments in early literacy. So since this is a library show, we'll talk a little bit more about early literacy. So kids in Flint, like in many inner city communities, there's about one book for every 300 children. Think about that. Wow. One children's book for every 300 kids. By the time our kids in Flint reach the age of three, they have heard 30 million less words. By 18 months, we see evidence of that achievement gap. By kindergarten, it's too late to bridge that gap. So we live in a word book desert. In response to this crisis, looking at the evidence of what is going to help our children, I received a small grant that launched something called Flint Kids Read. So right now in Flint, every single kid gets a book mailed to them every single month from the age of five. It's part of the Imagination Library program. Mm-hmm. We've massively expanded another program called Reach Out and Read. We used to only have one clinic that did that, and now we have over 10 pediatric clinics that do that. We started something called Born to Read. Babies born at the hospital get a bag of developmental tools. They get signed up for these programs, and they also get newborn board books. So lots of work is being done around literacy. And then hopefully one day they'll read my book. But right now they need to be reading these board books and hearing these words. So from early literacy to home visiting programs to Medicaid expansion to childcare and preschool, nutrition services, lots of great things are happening in Flint. And I get to be a part of that and to really be able to, in a data-driven way, share what we're doing to other communities.
For other cities around the country, what lessons should they be taking away from this? What experiences are they observing from this process?
Yeah, so we've already seen the positive ripple effects of this crisis because city after city is now paying attention to their water, they're paying attention to their infrastructure, and many have made massive investments in that work that needs to be done. But, you know, the reason that I wrote this book is to share other lessons for not just cities, but for every reader. You know, getting back at the title, What the Eyes Don't See, it's very much about Flint, but it's also so much more than about Flint. It's about people, places, and problems everywhere that we choose not to see. Those are those people. They live over there. That's not my problem. That's not going to happen to me and my family and my kids. And what the story and the lessons of Flint is that, hey, we need to open our eyes to these injustices that are happening all over, and that we have power within us to not accept the status quo and to make a difference in the lives of our most vulnerable populations, especially our children.
How can I help? What can I do? How do you answer that?
So if somebody specifically wants to help Flint, another reason I wrote this book was to give to our Flint Kids Fund. So right after the crisis, we created flintkids.org. It's the Flint Child Health and Development Fund, which is funding a lot of these interventions. It's funding the breastfeeding programs and the home visiting programs and the literacy work. So if somebody wants to give to Flint, flintkids.org. But you don't have to give to Flint. There are issues and there are things that you can do wherever you are in your community. So find something that you're passionate about and get involved.
Thank you for all your diligence and persistence in the work that you've done already and all that's yet to come. Any political aspirations for you in the future?
My constituency is the children, and that's who I will continue to remain loyal to.
Sounds good. Well, the title of the book, What the Eyes Don't See, buy or check out a copy today. Dr. Mona, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And you are listening to CattleCast.
Enjoying this podcast? Also check out the Executive Edition and Reader's Roundtable podcasts, available through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and the Cattle app.
To complement Cattle's Law & Order program series, we welcome Derek Parker. Derek Parker held the rank of Detective First Grade in the NYPD, and after working undercover on numerous homicide cases, Mr. Parker was assigned to unsolved murder cases, including those of late rappers The Notorious B.I.G. and Tupac Shakur. He has also written the book, The Notorious C.O.P. Mr. Parker, welcome to CattleCast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Did you always want to be a cop?
Well, I didn't have really much of a choice back then. My father was a Marine, and he was a cop. And I guess he wanted us to follow someone in his footsteps, you know, with civil service.
Absolutely. Well, now, the New York City Police Department has been the subject of many fictional portrayals through books, TV shows, movies, and even video games. Why do you think there's such a fascination with the department?
Well, because we have a multicultural community in New York. We have so many different people. We are very populated, and we're just a big city. And I think everybody loves New York because there's so much going on. It's the city that never sleeps.
As a NYPD detective, you headed up the RAP Intelligence Unit. Explain how this unit was created.
Well, what happened with that unit was that I had been following a lot of these rappers when I was doing cold case homicides. And apparently what happened was that when the homicide occurred in Las Vegas with Tupac, and then with Biggie Smalls, the chief and the police commissioner wanted me, because I had the intimate knowledge of this this culture, to be involved with this case. And that's how the whole thing came about.
And what is involved in that unit?
Well, basically, you know, there's always a database kept on a lot of these rappers from different cities that come to New York, and even the New York ones themselves, because some of these rappers become either perpetrators or victims or both. And then there was so much violence in the community at one time, the police department didn't understand it.
Do you feel the Tupac and Biggie murders will ever be solved?
Well, the pretty much so. The Biggie and Tupac murders are pretty much solved. I mean, Tupac's murder, the guys who killed him are dead or deceased. And the Biggie case is pretty much the same. There's probably one co-conspirator who's still around, but I don't know if they have enough on just his testimony alone to solve that case and close it.
Now, in another interview, you mentioned that the murder case of Run DMC's Jam Master Jay was real personal to you. Can you share why?
Well, you know, I was pulled back into that case after I retired. They asked me to come back and to help, and they were having trouble dealing with the police, you know, with the people involved in the case and the community. So they asked me to come back and help. And like I said, I got very close to people that were involved in the case to try to solve it. I did my best to try to solve the case. So this way, the community can have some closure. However, it's still pending.
Do you think the case will be solved for Jam Master Jay?
I think it will. I'm hoping that it will, because a lot of work has been done into that case. But it's just hard right now for the DA's office to proceed on it, because they want more information, and they don't want to lose a case like this if they bring someone to justice. You know, they want to make sure they get a conviction.
Why is the hip hop music world often blamed for crime and violence?
Well, the hip hop music world is a culture that these young youths kind of live by, like art imitates life. And some of the hip-hop predecessors of the rappers before the ones they are now, they were more gangsters. More gangster rap came out, and, you know, against the law, against the community. And it's somehow how changed it, where, you know, the people felt that you had to be really tough or be a bad guy to be a rapper.
Right. Tell me about your book, The Notorious COP, how that came about and some of the research that you did for it.
I know that it was very interesting that the writer, Matt Deal, my co-author, wanted to sit down with my friend Adam Lublin, and he wanted to put this together to explain to the world exactly what went on and why the NYPD created a unit like that. I think we were the first unit to ever have that in the country. And now I think there's other detectives in other cities that monitor some rap artists, you know?
Right.
But we were the first in the whole country to do it, because, you know, we were the clearinghouse for a lot of the rappers and the people that got killed and the violence that was going on. So that's how my book got started. I wanted to tell the story about these murders, about what happened, so people could understand what went on and why the unit was created.
And what are some of the questions or the advice that you would give to the other cities like that? I mean, if they come to you and they say, you know, how do we get started in something like this?
Well, right now, the other cities, and I've done my research a little bit, you have anywhere between 52 and 60 homicides open around the country of rap artists, or people that are affiliated with the rap music industry. And a lot of those cases are not solved. They're still open cases, because the police department sometimes, you know, they are not well educated on this community. I mean, a lot of them are now, but back then they weren't. And you got to remember, I had a homicide background investigation.
Right.
Before going into this intelligence unit. So I already had that type of credentials to handle such cases like these. There's a lot of detectives that don't or may not know how to deal with this community, because a lot of these artists, they don't come forward and talk to the police. They feel that snitching is get snitches, you know, that's the saying here. So they don't trust the police. Sometimes they don't want to talk to law enforcement. And that's what happens. So you have to win over the community.
Well, and it's probably sadly a never ending thing, but I would guess that your work is certainly helping not only in New York, but around the world, and perhaps certainly around the country, and perhaps we'll see less of this, or at least improvements in it.
Well, I think what I did back then was that I opened up a lot of eyes for a lot of police departments around the country to look into these murders or pay close attention to this community, because it can become violent sometimes, you know, especially on record, on the media. Recently, there was a case in Nicki Minaj, another rapper, Cardi B, fighting at the Fashion Awards. So you can see how it can go from one thing to another sometimes. And then it'll get big because it'll be publicized in the news. And then before you know it, it hits the streets, and then it's bigger than what we think it is.
So what are you doing now?
Well, right now, I'm a private investigator. and the Parker Consulting Group. My brother Ralph is involved with that with me. He likes to, you know, he wants to go out and to not only to provide security for people, not just artists, but other people that need it, but to provide, you know, a security presence at the airports, when they come into town, whatever their needs may be, cameras, things like that. So it's basically we go around and we give advice. We tell people what they think they need and what they may need for security just to keep themselves secure. But the private investigation side of it comes about when people have certain cases that they can't seem to get a handle on, and they may call me to help.
Well, we should mention for our library listeners, the ebook version of the Notorious COP is available through our Overdrive service, and the audiobook is available through Hoopla. So we hope people will check this out and learn a little something and become a little more educated about it.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope they can understand what happened back then, you know?
Right. Mr. Parker, thank you for joining us on CattleCast today.
Thank you very much for having me. Have a good day.
Rosie, A Detroit Hearse Story, is a remarkable story for young readers about women who worked in the factories and shipyards during World War II, producing munitions and war supplies. Their skill, bravery, tenacity, and spirit became a rallying point of American patriotism and aided in defining Detroit as the arsenal of democracy. The author is Bailey Sisoy Isgro, who is also the owner of Detroit History Tours and the proprietress of the Detroit History Club. She joins us now on CattleCast. Hello, Bailey.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
What inspired you to write the book?
Nicole and I were inspired to write the book when we recognized that so few books today have a woman in a lead role for children's books. And when we started looking into the data available on who is shown as a hero in children's books or as a main powerful character, it became even a smaller percentage. So as we started thinking about women that inspired us, we recognized we didn't need to create a superhero out of thin air, that these real superheroes existed in Detroit history, and that's where the idea for Detroit Her Story was born. We came up with several different women, and the original idea was maybe to do a coloring book or something with little parts of information, but as I started writing, it became pretty evident to both of us that Rosie was the direction we wanted to head for our first book. So for Rosie the Riveter, it makes a perfect fit to be a children's book hero for young men and young women. Somebody in American history, somebody in Michigan and Detroit history who overcame challenges, worked as a team, looked like every child out there, every race, every age, every shape and size, and could really be a role model kids could relate to.
Where did the term Rosie come from?
The term Rosie the Riveter actually came from a song written by James K. Keisner, who performed it with his big band. In the song, there's a lyric, all day long, whether rain or shine, she's a part of the assembly line. She's working for victory. She's making history. Rosie, Rosie the Riveter. And this song comes out, and it's not about one particular person, one woman named Rosie working at one factory as a riveter. It's an archetype. It's a song written in a way that uses the alliteration of Rosie and Riveter. And this title starts being one women war workers take on for themselves. They start calling themselves Rosies, and so do other people. So women who had previously been called women war workers took up the name Rosie, which was a lot more catchy, and started using it. Because of the song, Norman Rockwell was commissioned to do a cover for the Saturday Evening Post. There are multiple images attributed to Rosie, and Rosie sort of enters into the iconity of American history. Just like Uncle Sam, she is a representation of American patriotism for women, and later becomes a symbol of the feminist movement.
In what ways did Rosies in Detroit help win the war?
Rosies helped win World War II in every imaginable way. The term Rosie refers to any woman who did a job that was predominantly dominated by men during the Lend-Lease years before we got into World War II and during World War II. So these girls helped build Sherman tanks at the old Cadillac factory. They built, you know, B-24 Liberator bombers at Willow Run, ammunitions, uniforms, tents, radar, jeeps, you name it, they built it. Rosies also did things like keep family businesses open, keep bars and restaurants operating, take civic jobs like conductors on Detroit's railways in order to keep the home front moving and supply the material necessary for the Allies to win the war. It is not hyperbole to say these women helped win World War II just as much as the men and women at the front. It was in a different way, but their contribution led to the Allies' victory, and it's incredibly important.
I believe Mary Doyle Keefe, the model for Norman Rockwell's iconic 1943 Rosie the Riveter painting, died in 2015. While writing your book, were you able to meet a real Rosie?
We were able to meet some original Rosies. Both Nicole and I were part of the Rosie the Riveter world record win. The Guinness Book of World Records declared our 3,772 women to be the biggest gathering of Rosie the Riveter tribute Rosies in the world. And well at that event, we were able to meet several women who were real, honest-to-goodness Rosies during World War II. And it was a really cool experience to sort of get to give them a hug and get to show them what we did and to thank them for their service.
How important was it for you to write a children's book that focused on women's roles in history?
It was incredibly important for me to build a female character as the lead in a book. But it was equally as important for me to take a moment to recognize women's history. I think for a lot of students, especially at the middle school level, they may hear of one or two women in history, but by and large, they're learning about the men. And so it's important for me that before they reach college or high school, they've had some exposure to the amazing women that helped build our city and state and country, and also women of multiple ethnicities, multiple ages, so that every kid can see somebody who looks like them, somebody who might come from a similar background as them, and the amazing things they've achieved and been able to offer to the country's history, not only as an inspiration, but as a little bit of validation of their own importance. For both Nicole and I, we wanted to do a book we could be proud of, but we also wanted to do a book for the kind of kids we're proud of.
Where can our listeners find this book?
The book is available on Amazon.com, off the website from Wayne State Press, or at local and national bookstores all over the place. We hope you pick it up. We'd love for you to have a copy.
Bailey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed talking with you.
That's Bailey Sisoy Isgrow, author of Rosie, A Detroit Hearst Story, illustrated by Nicole Lapointe and published by Wayne State University Press. Stay tuned for more CattleCast right after this.
All the day long, whether rain or shine, she's a part of the assembly line. She's making history, working for victory. Rosie the Riveter keeps a sharp lookout for sound.
Do you want to win a Kindle Fire, movie passes, or other great prizes? Keep listening for the cattle keyword. Then email it to connect@cattle.org, along with your contact information. A winner will be announced during the next new episode of CattleCast. New keywords will be given each month, so keep listening to the CattleCast podcast.
Always dreamed of getting published? Courtney Tang, Cattle's digital literacy librarian, joins us now to talk about Cattle's upcoming Indie Author Day. So, Courtney, what is Indie Author Day?
Indie Author Day is an international event that takes place in October. Libraries and organizations around the world get together and they welcome local indie authors, writers, and their communities. So each library celebrates with their own local flair, and we'll be taking advantage of the rich community of publishing professionals that we have in this area. We'll be having three presentations on the business side of publishing and self-publishing. Then we'll be having an author panel that focuses on authors whose writing is set in Michigan.
So who are some of the authors that will be appearing?
We have, first up, John K. Addis. He's the CEO and creative director of the local Addis Enterprises, and he's also written a book called The Eaton. We have Alexandria Shore. Some may recognize her name. She's very active in the local writing community. She's an unconventional romance author. The author of Before Him Comes Me and In the Pursuit of Charity. We have Tobin Buick, who I think a lot of people will recognize his name because he's coming to see us a couple times this fall. And we have Christy Dickinson. She's a local court reporter, but also a romance writer. She has quite a few titles out, including Devil's Elbow, two series, The Harbor Secrets, and Katie Collins. And then from a little further afield, we have Stephen Mack Jones. He's a celebrated poet and playwright, and also the author of the thriller August Snow.
So who should come to this event? If you're an author that's trying to learn the ropes and get started, is this a good event for you? Or if you're looking how to get published, or what levels are best for this audience?
I think this is a good event for kind of a wide range of authors and writers, kind of just book enthusiasts. We have all these authors coming and they'll be doing presentations. From the author's perspective in the panel, they're going to talk about their experiences writing, they'll talk about publishing, and we have authors that are both indie published and traditionally published. So regardless of which side or type of publishing you're interested in, we have that kind of to appeal to you.
Probably bringing different perspectives on
exactly
things
too. That's the hope.
Right.
And then besides authors, we also have the three presentations we have on the business side. We've got the marketing side of it, but we also have Laura Klinstra. She's a local book designer. If anything I have to say about her is just go visit her website. It's a feast for the eyes, and we've linked it on our Facebook page and in our blogs. She's done work like The Lilac Girls and Circling the Sun. We also have Julie Taylor from MSU. She's in charge of the Espresso Book Machine. That's kind of a resource that's really good for people if they want to publish their own books, if they just want to print their own books, and it's open to the public. We have kind of a wide variety of attractions for people, so I feel like we can appeal to a wide variety of authors.
Now, can people purchase their books at this event?
Yes, most of the authors will be selling their books, and there will be a time just for kind of networking and meet and greet the authors and presenters at the end. So,
well, Indie Author Day, give us the date, time, and location.
It's Saturday, October 13th from 1 to 5 p.m.
Right here at Cattle Downtown.
Yes.
Lansing. All right, very good. Now let's shift a little bit. Tell us about haiku hiking.
Yes.
Just the name alone, it sounds interesting.
So this is kind of a unique thing. This is a program we're doing in collaboration with the Japan Outreach Coordinator of Michigan. Her name is Kanako Morishita, and she works for MSU. So basically, for anyone who doesn't know, haiku are a type of poetry from Japan. They're 17 syllables. Okay, it could take like maybe a lifetime to master haiku, but they're very fun to write. They're short and they're fun, and I think it's a great creative experience. So the purpose of this program is sort of to exercise our minds while exercising our bodies, albeit in a very relaxed way. We'll be learning about haiku from Kanako and then taking a nice leisurely stroll down some park trails.
And this event is taking place not in a library then?
No, so it is actually off-site. It'll be at Lake Lansing Park North. Parks and Rec has generously provided us some park passes, so we have for up to 15 vehicles, if you register, then passes provided. Yeah, so it should be fun. It's just an opportunity to learn something new and enjoy nature.
Right. Give us the date and time and location again.
That'll be October 21st from 2 to 4 p.m.
And that's at Lake Lansing North. And you said people should pre-register, is that right?
Yes.
And so the best number for them to call
is 517-334-1529. Of course, they can also register online at cattle.org/events.
All right. That sounds good. Fun stuff for writers and poetry lovers, haiku lovers, and all that.
Hikers.
Hikers, exactly right. Well, Courtney, thanks for telling us about all that. And one more thing before you go. Courtney, can you give us this month's cattle keyword?
This month's cattle keyword is indie.
Indie. All right. So email this month's cattle keyword indie to connect@cattle.org. That's connect@cadl.org. Courtney, thanks for joining us on Cattlecast.
Thanks for having me.
I guess we should call this our super segment. Joining me now are Lansing's Batman, Seamus Smith, and Katie Whitaker, who is also known as the Capital City Wonder Woman. I welcome you both to the Cattlecast podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So share with our listeners why you both decided to split your time as superheroes.
Well, I guess for me, I went to my very first Comic-Con last year. It was Grand Rapids Comic-Con, and I met Lansing Batman there. And he came up to me and was like, hey, I need a couple superheroes to do a few events with me. How to Halloween was coming up, and then the Justice League opener at Celebration. So I showed up to How to Halloween, assuming that I was just going to dress up as Wonder Woman and just have fun for the day. And within the first hour or two, I met a little girl who came up to me just jumping up and down, so excited to meet Wonder Woman. And her mom pulled me aside and she said, hey, she loves Wonder Woman because she's bullied in school because her skin's a little darker and her hair's really short. So I just spent 10-15 minutes talking to her and just encouraging her, telling her just how beautiful she was. And that was the turning moment for me. It wasn't, I'm going to dress up and have fun anymore. It was, I need to do this for the kids because I see the impact that seeing a superhero and being able to talk to a superhero can have, and especially on a little girl.
Mine is a little backwards from most cosplayers. I actually was involved in an accident with a little boy. He ran out in the road. He was caught by the front of my trailer, flew 90 feet. I did see him die on the side of the road. His mother was able to bring him back. She resuscitated him. She's a nurse. From that, turned into a fundraiser for the family. I found out that he grew up loving Batman. I grew up loving Batman as well. So I bought a cheap suit online and was going to show up at the fundraiser as Batman. It was too busy. Wasn't able to use it. Someone heard that I had it. I ended up doing a trunk or treating thing a few weeks later. First full night I had slept since the accident. And I realized interaction was a huge thing. Within a few weeks, I was at Capital City Comic Con. I ran into Jerry, who runs How to Halloween, and he had the Batpod there, which is the motorcycle from The Dark Knight. I spent hours helping little kids on and off the bike, interacting with some of them. There was a few that were handicapped, and that was a huge impression on me to see how it changed them in those few moments. It changed who I was in that moment. It allowed me to, one, finally sleep through the night, and two, realize what dressing up and being something in someone else's eyes can do.
Powerful stories there of how this got started. Now, I understand that you are members of a much larger group of superheroes. Tell us about the League of Enchantment.
Well, the League of Enchantment was started by Brittany Billinghurst last January, I believe. And she started it because she knew a little boy in the hospital battling some horrible things, and he ended up passing away. But she wanted to take that experience and be able to reach other kids. Seamus met with Brittany last November, and I'll let you tell the rest of that.
Yeah, I had a notebook full of ideas of things. I'd been doing Batman for almost 2 years at that point. I couldn't keep up. I was doing stuff for breast cancer, for American Cancer Society, a variety of other community groups. I couldn't do it by myself. I realized I needed a bigger group. I had this list of ideas. I sat down with Brittany one day, and actually it was the end of November, showed her the ideas. By the time we left that meeting, I was an admin on her Facebook page for the League of Enchantment. Pretty soon thereafter, Katie came on board with the League. By January, we had decided to step forth into the nonprofit world and become a certified nonprofit. And then at that point, I became the president. Katie's our treasurer. Brittany is our vice president. Another girl named Candy is our secretary. Brittany's boyfriend, Dominic, is a board member. And it has just exploded from there. Mm-hmm.
Recently, Cattled entered into a promotional partnership with the How to Halloween event, which is taking place October 13th and 14th at the Lansing Center. Tell us a little bit about that event.
It's kind of a celebration of the childhood part of Halloween. It's designed for kids, and it's really an amazing event. There's trick-or-treating for the kids. There's different vendors, though not many. It's not a vendor-focused event. It's more of an entertainment for kids event. So there's superheroes. There's princesses. There's the Ghostbusters there. There's Star Wars. There's all these different worlds coming together in one event for all these kids to actually see them move. It's live people doing all of the stuff. It's really incredible. We even have Beetlejuice there. He dances on stage, interacts with people. Myself as Batman, I try to walk around a lot. I don't tend to stand in one place. Neither does Wonder Woman.
Nope.
We tend to be very interactive people. For a kid and for an adult, it's an absolute blast. You get to meet those people that you grew up reading and seeing on TV. It's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. What is the attraction for kids or even for adults to the superheroes? What gets their attention? Why is the love so strong?
Well, growing up, anytime you go up to a kid, like, you usually ask them, hey, who's your superhero? Who's your hero? It's an automatic question to ask a kid. It's someone to look up to. You know, sometimes they answer their mom or their dad, which is amazing, and that's where you want it. But, you know, sometimes they need someone who's extra powerful because they have things going through their life, things that they're battling, and they need, you know, someone to look up to or believe in that can take away those hurts and pains and sorrows that they go through.
Yeah, being that we're here in a library, this is where people go to learn about these other worlds. As kids, we use our fantasy. We live in our imagination, and we use those strengths all through our lives, even if we don't realize it. Meeting our childhood hero, be it Daniel Boone, be it Batman, be it Wonder Woman, be it Eleanor Roosevelt, can change somebody. They realize that their heroes do exist.
If you could possess one superpower,
what would it be?
Myself, actually, most of my characters don't have superpowers. I do Batman, but I also do Iron Man and Moon Knight, none of which have superpowers. I've always been more into the grounded in humanity heroes, showing them that there's a positive thing out there.
I think I would want Flash's superpowers. I would want super speed.
Super speed.
Yep.
That would be a good one.
Yeah.
Truly, your superpower is how you bring great joy to all the kids in the community. Seamus Smith, Katie Whitaker, thanks so much for joining us today. We know you're going to have a great time at the How To Halloween event.
Thank you for having us.
For more information about the How To Halloween event, visit howtohalloween.com. Also, check out Caddle's digital comic books through Hoopla at cadl.org. More CaddleCast right after this.
When was the last time you used the library? Because the entertainment you love is ready to read, watch, stream, or download from movies to music to the latest bestsellers with no fees or nothing to return. Check it all out at cadl.org. Plus, download and enjoy magazines like ESPN, Golf Digest, and Men's Health on any mobile device for free. Just visit cadl.org. Capital Area District Libraries. Everything right here.
Another CattleCast is in the books. I want to thank all my guests and thank Kristen Shelley and the East Lansing Public Library for allowing us to record the Dr. Mona interview. Also, don't forget about our Indie Author Day event taking place at Cattle Downtown Lansing October 13th from 1 to 5 p.m. Finally, congratulations to the Swift Brothers, who won our Capital Area Cover Song Contest. They get a $500 Marshall Music gift card and will perform at Common Ground in 2019. So enjoy their winning version of Taylor Taylor's right here, and we'll see you next time for another episode of the CattleCast Podcast.
I'm still waiting for reality to come again. Sit tight, ride.